On this morning's docket is Ratik against Mansour and Robinson Brick. Counsel, you may set up a counsel table. Ready, you may proceed whenever.
If it please the court, I think the first thing, my name is Nathan Berger, and I represent the appellant Nicholas Baddock and the appellant Sandra Baddock. We would, at this point, make a motion to strike the supplemental authority filed by Robinson Brick. It's an unpublished opinion forbidden under the protocol of the Court of Appeals, and based simply on that, we would move that that supplemental authority be stricken.
Stricken?
Yes, Your Honor. It'd be struck from the record.
It's struck.
Yes, thank you. There's basically two key issues in this case. One is the summary judgment on the statute of limitations for a respondeat superior claim. The other is the constitutional issues surrounding the cost bond statutes as they existed at the time. They've since been amended in 2009, but that was after this action took place. I will go through the respondeat superior claim, and that claim is from the case aside. There's no Colorado precedent on when specifically does the statute of limitations accrue under the doctrine of respondeat superior. There's a lot of cases on statute of limitations, but none specifically on that issue. We have medical malpractice cases, products liability cases, but nothing that's exactly on point. The cases that I cited in the brief clearly show that they're two separate issues. The respondeat superior is a separate and distinct claim from the negligence of the employee. In one of the cases cited in the brief, the same statute of limitations didn't even apply to those cases based on the fact that they're separate and distinct claims. Here, our position is that based on the separateness that you need to find out the allegations, the facts that support your claim before you file it, how can you file a claim for respondeat superior until you know, have some basis to know that there's an employment relationship and that the actor was in the course and scope of employment?
And filed before 5 days of the end of the statute of limitations period. If they knew they were going to rely on discovery to figure out other facts, then it would have made sense to file a lot sooner, wouldn't it?
Well, that's true in certain circumstances. That may be if the person that hits you has a truck that's labeled, but in a personal car, if somebody rear ends you and you have, it's a personal car, does that, who would even think that maybe they were in the course and scope of employment if it wasn't disclosed at the time?
It's the middle of the day, wasn't it?
Yes, it was in the middle of the day.
So it would have been an easy question to ask the man, who are you working for? Are you doing this in connection with your job? If somebody thought there was any concern about the gentleman not having sufficient funds to pay the judgment?
Well, that's true, but he did have $100,000 worth of insurance, and that was disclosed to the police officer at the time. Most individuals have no idea about respondeat superior. Who would think that you ask somebody, are you working for somebody else at this time? It goes by, and you assume that if you're an attorney, I always am careful. I don't go out and actually talk to the individual, send them a notice. I'm an attorney. You better go get an attorney. If not, then you can talk to me. I think there's ethical concerns if you go out and start investigating with the individual. If you're an attorney and start asking questions, you should give them a chance to go get an attorney to represent them. At that point, I believe it should be disclosed that, yeah, hey, he was working. We're not the only insurance coverage. The statute at issue, I don't think is limiting. You only disclose your personal insurance, you disclose whatever coverage you would have. That should be required. Otherwise, it really offers a defendant or potential defendant purposes not to disclose. If I can keep this hidden long enough for the statute to run, I'm scot-free.
What does the fact that Mr. Mansour was employed have to do with either the existence of his injury or the cause of his injury?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. In a medical malpractice case, I guess you look at when you've discovered you were injured and products liability. But here, under respondeat superior, that's a separate and different claim. You don't know that there's any claim. You have no basis to know that you would even have a claim against them unless you knew there was an employment relationship that existed or had some reason to know.
And isn't the same true for Robinson?
Yes, for, well, that's a question, and there was never any talk about that, but I assume Robinson knew there was an accident. I assume it was reported to Robinson, and they were aware that there was an accident out there with their employee.
Is there evidence of that in the record?
Well, I believe in the record.
And I understood there was a stipulation that there was no reason for that Robinson did not know about the accident any sooner than when the individual defendant was actually served, which was sometime after the expiration of the statute of limitations.
No, Your Honor, they had no notice that there was a lawsuit filed. And that was it because they couldn't until the lawsuit was filed and served, and that was the stipulation. And I don't have the specific record, and I don't know if it's in there, so I won't refer to that. The cases that I cited on the where there was a ruling against somebody who sued the archdiocese, the court found, and I know it was dicta, but they were talking about why the summary judgment was affected. One, because the lady knew of her injuries, knew of the sexual assault when she turned 18, and that was her damages. Then goes on to say, and knew that he was employed, was a teacher at the archdiocese, and that seemed to be part of the equation in ruling on that motion for summary judgment. And that was a respondeat superior case, talking about the statute of limitations, although it went against the plaintiff. That was one of the facts that the Court of Appeals looked at in deciding that it did apply, that she knew there was an employment relationship there with the archdiocese at the time.
Is the test whether the plaintiff knew or whether the plaintiff knew or should have known?
Well, it's knew or should have known. And should have known is an issue. If somebody hits you and it's a yellow cab, maybe you should know they're working for somebody, or a UPS truck. But if it's a personal vehicle with no markings on it and there's no indication there was any way to tell, how would anybody know? I guess one of the ways to do it is you sue everybody's employer. Anybody hits you, you sue their employer. That would encourage a frivolous type of lawsuit, I think, encourage that type if you had to file before you found out. Or, on the other hand, encourage defendants to hide the fact that there's an employment relationship.
Or there might be a third alternative. It would encourage the plaintiff to do some investigation before they file.
Well, that's true. And the late filing, and I wouldn't call it late, it was filed before the statute ran. Often with injuries, you wait, see how the plaintiff is going to turn out. You don't run out and file immediately. You have to wait and see what the injuries are going to be. Are they going to be permanent? What's going to happen? What action do you need to take? Need doctors to look at them? Here it was alleged permanent injuries, closed head injury. Those things can take time and have to see. Hopefully you get better. If you don't, it affects what claims you would make. And I guess it depends what you do. Maybe you just throw out everything and make every claim you can right away. But there is a purpose for that. And the statute of limitations has been shortened from 6 years to 3 years. And so that just often have to wait and see what the injuries are going to do to the person and see what further treatment they need.
I guess that wasn't totally responsive to my question. Why couldn't the plaintiff, is there a burden on the plaintiff after an accident like this to do some pre-filing investigation to find out who might be liable here? Might be an employer, might be something wrong with the car, maybe there was a defect. I mean, so why wouldn't there be a burden on the plaintiff to try to at least investigate whether there was a potential employer here?
Well, there could be a burden on the plaintiff to do that investigation if, I believe, if there was some indication, some facts to raise that. Like I said, if somebody was driving a company vehicle, or there's some indication that there was an employment relationship, or they were in the course and scope of employment. But out of the accidents, I don't know how many of them, when it's just a private vehicle, you would even suspect that somebody's working in the employment scope of employment when they hit you. And the time of day could be that time of day, but that doesn't give automatically indication sufficient to believe that there's a course of employment going on. There should be some reason to look at, instead of, would you look at every accident to see that, every accident that happens to see if there's course of employment. Usually there should be some indication in the facts to raise that issue. And one of them should be, you should be told when you get hit, said, hey, I've got this insurance. My lawyer has it.
Mr. Berger, why don't you address the cost bond issue briefly, if you would, please?
Yes, Your Honor. The cost bond issue, I think one of the first issues is, what is the standard of review? We submit it's strict scrutiny, basically because right to travel is impinged, which is what the cases say, impinged. We allege it was violated.
Why do we get into this non-residency issue? I thought the trial court was pretty clear that the cost bond that was ultimately set had nothing to do with their residency.
Well, the trial court, I don't believe that was its ruling. It stated in the order of September 27th, and that's the CD number 1948016 on page 2, that it was raised because they moved out of state, because they traveled.
I agree it was raised, but I thought in his transcript of his ruling, he made it pretty clear that that may be why they filed the motion for a cost bond, but that was not the reason why he was imposing a cost bond.
Well, that was my understanding, was that was the reason he was required to do it on that time. He had no discretion but to order the cost bond. And although he said it wasn't unconstitutional under equal protection, because if he'd wanted to, could have done it on the plaintiff. But to do that on an in-state plaintiff, you have to find they can't pay the costs. That fits under the section 103. Plaintiff can't pay the costs. They're excused. There's a way.
Well, there's two different issues. If the costs had already exceeded $30,000, and the originally, I think the defendants were seeking a $40,000 cost bond, or the one defendant at least was seeking a $40,000 cost bond, and the court initially entered a $31,000 cost bond, concluded that they couldn't afford to pay that, but could post a $10,000 cost bond, and that they had the financial wherewithal to do that, even though they might not be able to make the total costs in the case. Is that an abuse of discretion by the trial judge?
Well, it's an abuse of discretion when it's done without looking at, not only are they indigent, but how does the requirement of paying a large bond impinge on your rights to have access to the courts? And that's stated in the new amendment to the statute. It says 5,000 is the limit, and specifically so it doesn't prohibit you from access to the courts. The legislature decided that. They also, in the new statute, gave the judge discretion. Says you don't have to post a cost bond.
So, I don't think the legislature made any findings, though, that the prior statute was unconstitutional, did it?
No, but they did change it to protect the access to the courts. That was their statement, that any more than 5,000, apparently, in their opinion, would interfere with the access to the courts.
Or under the old statute, so.
Well, we are, unless it's reversed, then the new statute takes effect and has a matter.
Right. What you're here for today is under the old statute.
Yes, the old statute is one that was in effect and gave the court no discretion. And in the Puerto Rico cases that were cited by the defendants, there's great, the cases basically say, well, we have discretion. If it was automatically applied, that could be a constitutional issue here, if there was a requirement without any discretion on the court. And the access to the courts is that issue.
Well, the court had the discretion, or had the ability to conclude that they could not post a $10,000 bond, and he specifically found that they could.
Well, he did, and there wasn't really a detailed finding, but the court did find that they weren't poor persons under the statute. He found they weren't indigent. That is also, I believe, an effect on their right to access to the courts. Just because you're not indigent doesn't mean you can go out and pull out $10,000 and put it. They applied to the bonding company and were rejected.
Oh, not for the $10,000 bond. There's nothing in the record that indicates they ever made an application for a $10,000 bond, is there?
Not for the $10,000. They made the application, I believe, for said $31,000.
I might be able to afford to buy a used Chevy for $10,000, but not be able to buy a Lexus for $40,000. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, that's true.
So here the court made a conclusion whether or not he could afford a $10,000 bond as opposed to a $31,000 bond.
Yes, and that's related to the discretion. Here we're talking about the constitutional issues, the right to travel, and the right of access to the courts. A different analysis under that. We submit that that would be a strict scrutiny test because it does clearly interfere with the right to travel, fundamental rights, and the fundamental right of access to the courts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berger.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is John Rodman, and I represent the defendant, Charlie Mansour. The plaintiff has raised three arguments on appeal. We will address the arguments briefly in the order in which they are presented. Mr. Wathan represents Robinson Brick, and we'll divide our time. He would like to preserve a few minutes to make some comments. The plaintiff's first argument involves the summary judgment order entered in favor of Robinson Brick Company on the statute of limitations. Mr. Mansour's involvement is only tangential in that respect, so we will rely upon the arguments that were presented on behalf of Mr. Robinson Brick. But nevertheless, it is the position of Mr. Mansour that the claim against Robinson Brick Company is purely derivative in nature, that both the cause of injuries and the nature of the fact of injuries were known to Mr. Batik on the day of the accident. Although stated in the trial court proceedings that counsel for Mansour may have concealed information pertaining to the actual identity of Mr. Mansour and operating the vehicle, or at least in his employment capacity at that time, that has not been presented to the court on appeal. As such, there would be no equitable basis for tolling the statute of limitations. At the time of the accident, the plaintiff had every opportunity to determine who, if anyone other than Mr. Mansour, was legally responsible for the accident. It's just commonplace in any kind of automobile accident for plaintiff's counsel to determine at the very outset, is the individual employed at the time of the accident? This is fundamental. And the statute provides specifically the statute of limitations and the definition of when an action accrues specifically places the obligation on the plaintiff and not the defendant to exercise reasonable diligence in determining who the legally responsible parties are. There was simply no due diligence shown in this matter. There's nothing in the record to suggest that efforts were made. And indeed, the complaint that was filed originally, the original complaint against Mr. Mansour, was filed just 5 days before the statute of limitations would have expired in that matter. In effect, the plaintiffs seek to impose a rule upon defendants that would require them to come forward at the time of a suit to identify not only other potential causes of action, but any other parties that may have been potentially responsible. Remember, the statute only requires a driver to provide proof of insurance. It doesn't require the driver to identify all possible insurers that could be potentially responsible for the driver's conduct. The plaintiff's next argument is that the trial court abuses discretion in dismissing their claims for failing to post a cost bond. I think the argument wholly is without merit. The court provided the Baddocks ample opportunity and repeated opportunities to post a bond. The court even lowered the amount of the bond that was originally set to give them opportunity to comply with the cost bond statute. Despite having the financial wherewithal that was demonstrated by the affidavits filed by the plaintiffs, they simply chose not to post the bond. There are two decisions made by the court that are subject to a...
Say the financial wherewithal. The most recent affidavits that were filed show that they had, that their liabilities far exceeded their assets. They had no income, and they had, I think, expenses of $3,500 a month.
Well, the original, the information was provided to the court was provided in a piecemeal fashion. Initially, we had requested a cost bond in the amount of $40,000, and the court had ordered one of $31,000. At that time, affidavits were filed that suggested that they had assets that were accessible assets, which is the operable term, consisting of automobiles and jewelry and cameras and things of that nature of $32,000. So those affidavits, that information, the information that they had sought a bond from Above All Insurance Group and were rejected, a bond that they sought in the amount of $40,000 when the court's order was only for $31,000, failed to demonstrate to the court that these people were somehow impecunious and could not come up with the bond. So I would suggest to the court that this record fails to demonstrate that they were poor people, that Judge Hagelin gave them several opportunities, repeated opportunities to come forward with something to demonstrate that, and they simply failed to do so. The second arguable abuse of discretion would have been the amount of the bond required. And again, the court had lowered that to $10,000 in August of 2008. They failed to present any reason why at that stage, why they could not come up with that bond amount. The plaintiffs next argue that the equal protection denial due process infringement upon their constitutional right to travel and access to the courts were denied by virtue of the trial court's imposition of the cost bond requirements.
Mr. Rodman, isn't the trial court subject to some restraint on discretion in the amount of the cost bond simply by the purpose of it? I mean, the purpose, as I understand it, is to protect litigants from having to be subjected to litigation by out-of-state residents without any assurance that if they win, their cost of the litigation will be covered. And at some point, if you reduce the bond to a point where someone can physically afford to pay for it, you may, in fact, end up violating the purpose of the cost bond to begin with.
I think that's a very good point, Your Honor. And quite honestly, I could not find any comments from the original enactment of the statute as to why the statute was imposed. And there's been commentary, obviously, particularly in other courts in other states, that the cost bond statutes are in place for the very purpose that you say, to make sure that the defendant is not deprived of an opportunity to recover costs without some extraordinary efforts. Because in a situation like this, they moved to Texas, it would be necessary for us to go down, we'd have to reduce the judgment to, reduce the award of costs to a judgment. We would then have to take it down to Texas, try to enforce the judgment there under a recognition of Colorado law concept. We'd have to retain counsel at that point to proceed with the collection. So, yes, I think there is discretion in the court to do that. And Judge Hagelin specifically said when he was lowering the amount of the bond that, you know, I'm concerned here. I don't want to keep these people from trying their case, but I have to recognize that there are some other purposes that have to be guaranteed. And the statute does indeed speak in terms of the word, it uses the word shall when there has been a showing of a need to post a bond and the absence of indigency.
We need to reach the constitutional issues with regard to residency and non-residency in this case?
I don't think you do. I think the constitutional issues that are raised are with respect to residency, they're raised in a number of different areas. We have argued it extensively, and the Attorney General has filed an amicus curiae brief on this that we would also adopt. With respect to the equal protection aspects of it, looking at the Parrish versus Lamb case, I think we would conclude that this was a rational basis as opposed to a strict scrutiny standard that the plaintiff is apparently arguing now.
Getting into the merits of the constitutional issue, and I appreciate that, but my question is, some of the question I asked Mr. Berger is, didn't the trial judge in this case say he didn't need to, he wasn't ultimately basing his bond on the non-residency issue, but rather on his concern that the defendants wouldn't be able to pay the costs?
Your Honor, he did say that, but he also had entered a number of rulings prior to that time with respect to the cost bond, and it seemed that from the beginning he had entered the order that there would be required a cost bond. When counsel requested a hearing on that, an evidentiary hearing was given on that, he did say that. I think there's a sufficient basis probably for the court to say that there is not a constitutional issue, but I would be, I think, remiss if I didn't address that issue.
Perfect.
So that would be my concern specifically. But with respect to the standard that would be applied in determining the constitutional issue, it would be a rational basis standard. And I think, as Judge Graham has mentioned, I think there is indeed a adequate a rational basis. With respect to the impingement on one's right to travel, there's a number of cases that have addressed that issue. It does not, the cost bond statute does not directly affect interstate travel. And that is one of the requirements in the Article 4 of Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution. And it certainly doesn't diminish a basic necessity of life. I mean, here they were able to bring the action, they commenced the action initially. They were able to address those kinds of concerns that they had. And when the courts talk about the basic necessities of life, they're talking about health issues. They are talking about things such as the right to vote, if there's an undue waiting period before you can become eligible to vote, things of that nature. But we don't believe it rises to that level. We believe the plaintiffs have been given an ample opportunity to comply with the court's orders in this respect, an over ample opportunity, and we request that the order of the court be affirmed. Thank you.
Mr. Rodman.
May it please the court, Your Honors. I'm Mike Wathen on behalf of Robinson Brick Company. Good morning, and I just want to follow up on a couple of points with regard to the statute of limitations issue and the equitable tolling issue. First, with respect to the equitable tolling issue, Maddox cite no factual issue that should toll the statute of limitations in this case. They simply cite to an allegation that a person stopped for a traffic accident has to identify all possible insurance and employment relationships that may be out there. The statute regarding compulsory insurance simply requires production of proof of that insurance. So there's no facts of the record with respect to equitable tolling. Also, with respect to equitable tolling, the appellant Baddix are talking about the alleged wrongful conduct of Mr. Mansour, not my client, Robinson Brick Company, and therefore no equitable tolling should apply as to Robinson Brick Company.
Mr. Mansour, the employer, at least at the time, the employee of Robinson Brick?
That's true.
And when he was driving, wasn't he acting on behalf of Robinson Brick, or performing his duties, I should say, anyway?
Well, Your Honor, that is a question that has not been resolved yet.
But that's what's raised in the complaint.
That's true.
The Third Amendment complaint, or whichever complaint.
That's true. Mr. Mansour says that he was within the course and scope of his employment. Robinson Brick Company is without knowledge.
So without getting into whether he did do any wrongful concealment, if he did, wouldn't it be appropriate to attribute that to acting in the course of his employment?
I don't think so, Your Honor, not in terms of equity, because I think the equitable argument to deny Robinson Brick Company's rights under the statute of limitations, I think there should be a wrongful conduct shown on behalf of Robinson Brick Company.
If he was fighting for a bid and he shot the opposing bidder, I mean, Robinson Brick would probably, and that was pursuant to his job duties, shot's not the right word, but he took some sort of action that was wrongful towards a competitor or something, fixed prices or whatever, Robinson Brick would be responsible for that, wouldn't they?
To the extent he was acting within his agency or scope of employment, that's true. Your Honor, and then with regard to the statute of limitations issue, I think, you know, Appellant Baddock's argument is that there is no statute or case law that applies to directly address whether there is a statute of limitations for a respondent superior claim, and I disagree. I think the motor vehicle statute of limitations does address it because the statute says it applies to all claims arising out of the use or operation of a motor vehicle claim. Because this is a derivative claim, it also arises out of the use or operation of the motor vehicle, and it would be 3 years. And despite having 3 years to conduct an investigation, the Baddocks chose to file their complaint within days before the statute of limitation expired. There's no requirement in the case law that they have knowledge of the specific employer. Mr. Berger did address the, and I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Mr. Waltham, we'll give you one additional minute.
Okay, thank you, sir. The cases cited by the appellant Baddocks, none of those address the knowledge of the employer being a material fact that has to be known before the statute accrues. They all deal with the injury or the cause of injury. Specifically today, they addressed, Mr. Berger addressed the Sandoval versus Archdiocese of Denver case, and Mr. Berger alleged that that case considered the identification of an employer, but that wasn't the issue in that case. The issue in the Sandoval case was whether the respondent superior claim would be subject to the 6-year statute of limitations with respect to sex offenses as compared to a 2-year statute of limitations. And the comments of the court with respect to the identity of the employer, we think was just dicta.
Thank you, Mr. Waltham. Mr. Berger, you consumed all your time, but I'll give you an additional minute as well since I gave the other side another minute.
I'll make it short. The statute clearly, cost bond statute clearly violates the right to travel. It says on its face, if you're a resident of this state and decide to move to another state, you pay the cost bond. No discretion in the court. It directly affects the right to travel. You can't leave the state unless you want to face Baddocks. $10,000, gee, that's a good deal. Most people can't afford $10,000, $30,000, $40,000, whatever. That stops them from having access to the court. Directly impedes their right to travel. If you're in this state, you dare to move out, it's going to cost you. That's clearly a violation of the fundamental right to travel. Access to the courts, it's not a revolving door. You don't go in, go up, can you pay the toll? Nope, right out the revolving door. Never once was any issue in this case heard by a judge or a court or a jury as was requested. Just, can you pay the cost bond? No, you're out here. We would submit that this needs to be addressed. The cost bond issue is unconstitutional, been avoided numerous times. The last case, the Supreme Court said, yes, it could be applicable, but we decided to hold on statutory grounds. But if it didn't, the Constitution would come in and be an issue in this case. We would submit that the cost bond statute is unconstitutional as applied because they moved out of state and were subject to that by their travel, and would ask that the court reverse that and set things right under the Constitution in accordance with the mission statement of the Colorado State Judicial Branch. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berger. Thank you again, Mr. Rodman, Mr. Waltham. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.